The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha. Homage to the Dharma. Homage to the Sangha. This morning we offered the merit of our meditation and of our practice today to those who are suffering as a result of the earthquake in Japan. It is really helpful for us to remember and appreciate our connection with all living beings, and to be able to recognize the merit of our practice and the power of our good intentions in being able to help and benefit other beings. When we offer merit, it actually opens us to see and to be receptive to what it is that we might do to help. In addition to offering the merit of our practice. This week I have been reflecting on the precepts as Jukhaya's coming up, taking of the 10 precepts, and really being uplifted and benefited by reading and studying different aspects of the Dharma that came my way. In particular, I was inspired by an article in Animal Times, which is particularly relevant, actually, right now, given what is going on in Japan. It's called The Dog in the Lifeboat, and I'd like to share a piece of it with you. Jane Goodall's Global Roots and Shoots program engages young students in discussions about animal behavior, ecology, conservation biology, and the nature of human-animal interactions. This article, incidentally, is by Mark Beckoff. And he says, in a third grade class that was part of the Roots and Shoots program, I've posed the following question as an often used thought experiment to a group of young students. There are three humans and one dog in a lifeboat that can only hold three bodies. Which of the four should be thrown overboard? Generally, when this situation is discussed, most people agree that, all other things being equal, reluctantly the dog has to go. But the students didn't give up easily. The level of discussion overwhelmed me. What really amazed and pleased me was that after we had discussed alternatives, the students wanted to work it out so that nobody had to be thrown overboard. I experienced this line of reasoning in numerous different countries in similarly aged kids. Okay, these are third graders. They said, let's not do it. You know, why does anybody have to be thrown overboard? Let's not do it. When I said I thought the thought experiment required that at least one individual had to be tossed, they said it wasn't acceptable. Yeah. Then they started to generate ideas about how all the individuals could be saved, such as having the dog swim alongside of the boat and feeding her, having them all take turns swimming, throwing shoes and all the other things that weren't needed overboard in order to reduce weight and bulk, and cutting the boat in two to make two rafts. Isn't that terrific, really? This really has inspired me for the past 2 weeks. Every time I think about this, you know, I just feel uplifted by it. All the students thought even if the dog had to go, she would have a better chance of living because more could be done by the humans to save the dog than vice versa. He says, I sat there smiling and thinking, now these are the kinds of people in whose hands I'd feel comfortable placing my future. Hey, these are 7 and 8 year old kids. So, they didn't accept the basic premise. You know, which really raised the question for me, how often do we accept the basic premise and then just go right on, you know, without looking back? Reb Anderson has written a book called Being Upright on the Bodhisattva Precepts. He is a disciple of Suzuki Roshi's and a former abbot of Zen Center. And he says, very simply, whenever we deny our basic connection with other beings, the Bodhisattva precepts are broken. He says, the fundamental delusion, and this is what I would call the basic premise, the fundamental delusion of human beings is the belief that we exist separately and independently from the rest of the universe. There is the whole universe, a human thinks, plus something, and that something is me. Once we misunderstand ourselves in this way, it is inevitable that we will be primarily concerned with this isolated, precious self. We will single-mindedly focus on protecting and promoting our separate individual welfare, ignoring our close connection with all beings, animate and inanimate. We will act selfishly through greed, hate, and delusion. So the precepts are the ways of thinking and doing that put us in harmony with our Buddha nature and put us in harmony with our connection with all living beings. The essence of them is that we have to keep them toward ourselves as well as toward others. So if we deny our basic connection with others, we are turning away from our own Buddha nature as well as theirs. We are deluding ourselves, we're kidding ourselves. We're lying to ourselves. We are stealing from our own treasure house. There is this kind of interconnection. It is so very close and intimate. Now, the cover of this book, Being Upright, has this character. This is very strong, is it not? I found just looking at it was very helpful. The character, Reverend Master Hubert tells us, pertains to that which is human. And of course, the red is the bloodline of the precepts that is handed down to us through the Buddhas and ancestors. So, the title, Being Upright, has to do with sitting up straight, as Reverend Master Jiyu used to tell us, sitting up straight in the presence of the Buddhas and ancestors. If you are new to the practice, or if you are exploring the practice, and you're not altogether sure about the Buddhas and ancestors, then we can sit up straight in the presence. Simply in the presence. We come to the monastery because we have a hunch, we have a clue that there is something that is greater than ourselves. And when we sit up straight in the presence of it, him, her, she, however you want to think of it, we are opening ourselves to being able to receive. And simply opening up our hearts. So Zen emphasizes the profound connection between body and mind. When we sit up straight, we are aligning ourselves with the teaching of the Buddhas and ancestors. And of course, this is the position that we are taught when we come for meditation. That's the basic position, sit up straight. And you know, this, it's not a military posture, but it is putting ourselves in alignment with what it is that we already know. We're not kind of leaning forward into something that we're wanting, something that, you know, we're just kind of trying to get there, and we're not kind of pushing away and backing off. We are simply sitting up straight, and we are opening ourselves to the teaching that is constantly being offered to us. And you can actually experiment with this. You know, I always have to smile when I think about the wisdom of the teaching that is in our popular culture. How many times can we remember our parents used to say, sit up straight? Because we all recognize something about that. You know, we all recognize that. We are putting ourselves in alignment with something that we know to be true. So, you know, this is the thing. We already know, we already have what we need in order to do what we need to do. We already know that. We know that. You know, looking around the room, I can say, I can testify to that. We have what we need. And I think it's interesting in this day of, I mean, it's wonderful how much access we now have to Buddhist writings, to Buddhist books, to all kinds of teaching, to, you know, all kinds of things that we can access on the internet, endless Dharma talks and articles and all of the, gosh, you know, increasing number of teachings that are being offered. And it can lead us to believe that, gee, there's just one more thing I need to read or do before I can actually do this practice. Gee, if I could just read that, or, you know, maybe I ought to get that, or listen to this talk, or whatever. And while all of these things are very, very beneficial, and I found them very helpful when I was reading and preparing for this talk, you know, it just, the thing that keeps coming up for me is, we have what it is we need to do the practice. The question is, are we willing to do it? Are we willing to do it? Because the teachings are already pointing us back really to the ancient truths, you know, that we all have within ourselves. That's why so often when people come to this practice to learn the meditation or to hear some of the basic teachings, I have many times heard people say, gosh, it's like coming home. It's like coming home. And there's a kind of a recognition. There is a sense of relief, you know. Something deep, deep within us is deeply confirmed and recognized. So, whenever we deny that, we cause ourselves suffering and we cut ourselves off from our deepest wish and from our hearts. Often people say, you know, when contemplating the 10 precepts, gee, I feel overwhelmed. You know, how in the world am I going to understand these? How am I going to practice them? Where do I start? You know, where do I start? And one place that we could start is by asking ourselves, are we excluding someone or something? Are we just seeing with one eye? And if you're not certain about this, one example would be to just be aware of your reactions when you watch the news on TV. Many people say, you know, that it's harder and harder to watch the news because of the kind of what can get churned up in terms of grief, in terms of anger, in terms of outrage at what it is we are doing to one another and to the planet. And so we find ourselves polarizing, drawing lines of good and bad, right, you know, the right position, the wrong position, victims and perpetrators. And we can ask ourselves, you know, how do we begin to work with that? I mean, we'd like to turn off the TV, but, you know, that's a short-term solution, really. Because at this present time in our world, there is really a very deep need to overcome divisiveness and to work together, find ways of working together to find our way through the profound crises we are facing in our world, in the environment that supports and sustains us, in our political strategies, in our economic system, health issues. You know, these are all things that you all are familiar with. And so how is it that we are going to find ways to work together to embrace our differences? Hui Ning says, the Bodhisattva vow, the first vow, which says, however innumerable beings may be, I vow to save them all. Hui Ning says we start by saving them in our minds. How often have we asked ourselves, what in the world is that vow and where do we even begin? You know, well, we can kind of begin one by one in one situation at a time that presents itself to us. And then we have to act on having saved all beings in our minds. You know, how do we act on that? And I would like to share a couple of examples. Of people who did just that. This first one is from Robert Aiken's book, The Mind of Clover, which is a book he has written on the precepts. And he gives this example. Recently, leaders of a peace organization arranged to meet with the senior military officer who had broad authority. He said, I don't know why he agreed to meet with them, and I didn't hear the outcome of the meeting. I was just told about the discussions in the organization before the meeting took place. The delegation had to decide what to say. After role-playing several scenarios, the members gave up, and they decided to just open the conversation with the question, how's it going? In other words, with your truly awesome power, with nuclear war a possible outcome of something that you might decide, something that you might decide to do in an emergency, how are you bearing up? When we speak from the same side of the counter in this way, then we are human beings together. The we-they dichotomy falls away, and peace has a chance. I must say, I found this really quite, I just was extremely moved by this because I had never actually thought of the situation from this point of view. How does someone who has been given this kind of power and authority, whether or not we think it's a good idea, here is this person in this situation, how are they bearing up under that burden? I mean, something in the heart just opens up when you look at it in that way. So this being upright, you know, this wonderful image here, this is not actually a posture of this isn't a military stance where you're kind of like this and you're ready to say now, hear this, you know. It really is a mind of softness and receptivity and flexibility. It's a posture of listening. And I would like to share with you another story of another example of two people who didn't accept the basic premise. So Reb Anderson says, once I was listening to the radio and I heard a wonderful story. A cantor named Michael Weiser and his wife Julie had moved with their family from Chicago to Lincoln, Nebraska. In the Jewish tradition, a cantor is one who sings or chants the liturgical music and leads the congregation in prayer. They felt that their children would be exposed to less anti-Semitism there in Lincoln than they had been in the big city. As it turned out, the Grand Dragon of the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan of Nebraska, Larry Trapp, lived there. When he found out the Weisers were living in Lincoln, he turned his ongoing campaign of hate mail and phone threats against them. Of course, the Weisers were alarmed to experience such violent prejudice and were at first quite angry. However, after some time, the cantor had a change of heart because he felt that his faith taught him to love his enemies, and he wanted to put his faith into practice. Julie agreed, and they contacted the Grand Dragon by phone with friendly intentions. The Weiser family found out that Larry Trapp was a diabetic. He was confined to a wheelchair, and he was gradually going blind. So they called and kindly offered to help him with grocery shopping. His first response was an angry one, but after a pause, his mood changed, and he thanked them for offering. The Weisers continued in their attempts to embrace their enemy. Finally, Michael suggested that they prepare a dinner and take it to Larry Trapp's apartment, and he reluctantly accepted their offer. When one of the cantor's friends heard about their plan, he admonished Michael for going too far. Nevertheless, the Weisers did go to Larry Trapp's apartment. It was a dark and sad place with pictures of Hitler on the wall. But the dinner went fairly well. Gradually, Larry Trapp softened and his hostility subsided. He told the Weisers how his father had taught him to hate everything that was different from his white Christian family. Later, when speaking of that dinner, Larry Trapp explained that he just couldn't resist the Weissers anymore. He had never known love like that in his life. Larry Trapp completely let go of his hatred and he was transformed. He resigned from the Klan and he wrote formal letters of apology to groups representing African Americans, Native Americans, and Jewish Americans. When he was diagnosed as terminally ill, he even moved in with the Weiser family, and he converted to Judaism before his death. In order to fully practice the precept of embracing and sustaining all beings, we must become aware and finally include whatever we have abandoned or rejected. You know, this Shushogi tells us that a little girl of 7 even may be a teacher of the 4 classes of Buddhists and the mother of compassion to all living beings. These third graders have inspired my week, and I hope they will do the same for you. We don't have to wait for these dramatic circumstances in order to practice this teaching, because many times throughout the day, you know, the opportunity comes up to throw somebody out of the lifeboat. Let's not do it. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.